Okay, well, it looks like it's about 6. You want to get started? Okay, is the recorder going?
Yes,
sir. Oh, we're set. Okay, perfect. All right, well, it is November 18th, 2019, 6 o'clock p.m. We're in the Mill Creek City Council Meeting Chambers. I'm Phil Alvarez, hearing examiner. Have a preliminary plat application to review today, file number 2019-0011. this is an opportunity for the public to comment on what they think about a proposed subdivision of land into 25 lots here. We're going to be reviewing impacts on neighbors as well as primarily focusing on whether, you know, there's adequate streets and open space, parks, all that kind of stuff to serve the project site. The subdivision review process is geared at ensuring that we have proper infrastructure to accommodate new growth. The hearing format will be, you'll start off with a presentation from staff, and that's Ms. Ringstead, right? It'll be giving us an overview of the project, tell you what it's all about. Once she's done, then the applicant's turn. They'll have an opportunity to make a pitch, I'm presuming, in favor of their project. And after that, then we'll open it up to public comments. That's the time for the neighbors and anybody else who want to come in and say something about the project. Then we move back to a staff rebuttal, which is their chance to answer questions that were raised or present additional evidence they think in response to what was presented before that they think might be useful. And then finally, as a matter of constitutional due process, the applicant gets the final word. And once the hearing is closed, I get 10 business days to issue a decision. I believe in the city of Mill Creek, that decision is appealable to the city council. But even if there were an appeal filed with the city council, it's important to recognize that the council is not allowed by state law to consider new evidence. So if there's information that you want to have considered, make sure it gets into the record today before I say the hearing is closed. A lot of times I'll say the hearing is closed and the people will clear out the room, then someone will run up and say, oh, I forgot to submit this letter. At that point, even though it might be 30 seconds after the hearing is closed, it's too late because people who left the room didn't have a chance to see the letter or respond to it. So like I said, if you want to get information, make sure you get it in before the hearing is done today. All testimony has to be taken under oath, so if there's any chance any of you may be speaking today, even if it's just to answer a question, I need you to stand up right now to be sworn in. You all swear affirm or tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You're sworn in now. Those of you who don't have a microphone in front of you, and that's everybody except myself and staff, will need to go up to the microphone up there. It's not that we like to see you get some exercise, but we just need to make sure that all your comments are recorded. Once the hearing is done, I go back and I listen to the recording to make sure I respond to all your comments. Also, if this matter is appealed to Superior Court, the court will demand a written transcript of everything that was done, and if we can't produce it, they make us do this all over again. So we try to get it right the first time. And that's also why if you're yelling comments out from the back, I'll make you come up to the microphone because the microphones often don't pick up those comments from the back, and we don't get that transcript that we need. So any questions about what we're doing today or how the process works? All right, then. Now, finally, Ms. Rigsett, we'll let you get up there. Now, by state law, I'm only allowed to consider evidence that's presented during the hearing today. I'm not allowed to talk to staff about the project or the applicant or anybody else. That way you know exactly what information I'm considering for my decision, and you have an opportunity to respond to it if you think it's incorrect or needs some clarification or something. So it's important that I identify exactly what documents I'm given ahead of the hearing, and the staff report contains a list on Attachment D, which goes through Exhibits 1 through 23 and then skips 24 and goes to 25 for the staff PowerPoint. And those documents include the application, the staff report itself, title report, project narrative. They've got a geotech report and a critical areas report and a traffic impact analysis and a couple letters saying there's adequate water and sewer available from the Silver Lake Water and Sewer District and so on. We get comments from the fire department as well. Any objections over these documents coming into the record? Okay, hearing then, Exhibits 1 through 23 and Exhibit 25 are admitted into the record. All right, Ms. Briggs, now you can
move forward. Hearing examiner.
Sure.
For the record, my name is Sherry Ringstad. I'm an associate planner with the City of Mill Creek, and I was the project planner for this application, so I'll be presenting the staff report. A quick overview, it is a preliminary plat. It's subdividing 3.2 acres into 25 lots. The plat also includes tracks for open space, roadway buffer, and stormwater detention. Here's a vicinity map to get you oriented. The road that's going horizontally across the top there, that is 132nd Street or SR 96. It is a state highway. You can see Lowe's, just to the left, the big white roof, and then the Jackson Sports Fields just to the south of Lowe's. Then you see the little round dot. That is the Silver Lake Water District Water Tower. And the site itself is in the red rectangle there. This is a phase two. There was a phase one, and you can see phase one in the photo. It's the loop road that goes to the west here. There were 25 lots in that phase, and when that was developed, it was developed with a temporary turnaround down here because there was only the one side. With this development of the second phase, they will be taking out that temporary cul-de-sac and can then develop the one remaining lot in phase one that hasn't yet been developed. You can see it's surrounded by residential development. This is the Westlake Court, I think it is.
Wexford Court.
Residential development to the south and east. And then up here on the corner, that's a commercial. That's a Frontier Communications building. Okay. For public noticing requirements, we did issue an MD&S on October 21st. The appeal period expired on November 5th, and no appeals were filed. The public hearing was noticed. It was published in the Everett Herald, which is our paper of record. It was mailed to surrounding property owners. Our code requires everyone within 500 feet of the subject site get notified by mail. And in addition to that, this, of course, did include all the Phase 1 residents. In addition to getting the public hearing notice in the mail, I got their contact info for their HOA. And I sent them an email with a copy of the staff report and the public hearing notice, and just a couple of summarized points in the email, and asked them to contact me if they had questions. Because it is such a closely integrated neighborhood, we wanted to make sure they had every opportunity to know about it. The subject site itself was physically posted on the 6th, and we also post, like, on the bulletin board at City Hall, both City Hall buildings, the library. We put it on the city's website, along with all the attachments to the staff report also go on the city's website. A little bit of background information. Currently, it's three lots. They're being aggregated, and there are two single-family residences on the lots right now and several outbuildings. You can see in the photo a couple of the existing residents. The remainder of the site is undeveloped. It's primarily lawn-ish, and there's a grouping of trees in the southeast corner. The topography of the site is relatively flat. It does have just a little bit of a gentle slope to it. It slopes to the north and the east. And here's a copy of the proposed preliminary plat. You can see the phase one development is on top up here to the west. And this phase two is going to complete that loop road. So it's going to be one loop road, both taking access off of 23rd Lane to 132nd Street, SR96. There's also a roadway buffer tract, track 997. It's right up here by the entry drive-in. That is a code requirement, a 50-foot roadway buffer for residential development. In the very northeast corner right here is track 999. That is a wetland and a wetland buffer tract. And then just to the south, track 998, which is a storm drainage tract. This is where the storm vault's going to go. But it will also serve as an open space recreation area. There's going to be lawn on top, and as a condition, we're asking the developer to install some children's playground equipment and a couple of benches. And it'll just function as like a mini park, a tot lot, not a neighborhood park. You can see the temporary turnaround cul-de-sac up here on this map, and this final lot right here is the one that can be developed once the entire loop road goes in. Okay, here's a couple of existing site photos. Starting on the top left, this is standing in that temporary cul-de-sac turnaround facing towards the Phase 2 site. You can see that red house there. That is on the Phase 2 site. The photo to the right, this is standing in that driveway, the 23rd Lane, looking out to 132nd. You can see when the first phase was developed, they did put in full frontage improvements. They put in both sides of the road there. And then the photo on the bottom, this is standing in that same entry drive, but facing the other way, facing to the south. And right now there's a temporary private drive that serves those two single-family residences down there. You can see the houses that are in phase one just to the right of the photo there. Okay. There is, in the staff report, a complete matrix that looks at the consistency of the proposed development with the code. I'm not going to go into every single point, but it's in the staff report if you want to take a look at it. I just want to hit a couple of highlights. The development regulations do require, because this is medium density residential, they have a minimum requirement for density, and that's 5 dwelling units per acre, and a maximum of 12 dwelling units per acre. And the applicant is proposing 10. So they're well within the range that's allowed by the code. The code also requires landscaping of the right-of-way and the roadway buffer and the streetscaping. This would be the street trees. They are providing a sidewalk on both sides, a planter strip with street trees, and all of this landscaping does go to the design review board for review and approval. Utilities will be undergrounded as required by the code. And one kind of significant difference between this and phase one did request a modification to the setbacks. And with the second phase, they decided just to go ahead and meet the setbacks. So that means all the rear yards are going to have the 25-foot setback, which is quite a change from that first one, because the first one in places, the rear yards went down to 10 feet. Stormwater facilities. The city doesn't have the engineering staff to review these, so we do have a consultant to review the civil plans and the drainage plans. And they have reviewed them and found them to be consistent with the code. And their memos that acknowledge that it is consistent with the code are contained in the project file. The stormwater flows to the north, the existing stormwater flows to the north and east into Wetland A. The new drainage system, which we talked about when I had the plat map up, that's the vault that's going under track 998, that will be required to meet DOE regulations. And the project drainage will be routed to that stormwater vault in track 998 and be treated prior to release from the site. And it will release into the city storm drainage system on 132nd, so it will maintain its current flow pattern. And for wetland buffer averaging, it's similar to engineering. We don't have the environmental scientists on staff, so we send it out to a consultant. ESA reviews wetland reports for us. There is a Category 4 wetland on the site, and that does require a 50-foot buffer, and that's in that very northeast corner up there. The applicant is requesting buffer averaging. That is allowed by code. And what this means is the stormwater vault here, the darker red hatched area, they want to reduce the wetland buffer by 641 square feet in that area just so they can, you know, fit in the stormwater vault. But then they're adding 641 square feet, which is shown in the blue, just on the western edge of the buffer here. And they do meet, there's certain criteria in the code that you have to meet. Can't be more than 25%, can't be more than half the reduction, and they meet all of that criteria, and our environmental consultant has given us a memo saying that they are meeting the requirements of the code. In addition to that, there's 9,800 square feet of buffer enhancement. Right now, the buffer around that wetland is fairly degraded. There's quite a bit of blackberry and invasive vegetation there. So as the buffer will be enhanced by removing that invasive vegetation and planting with natives, so there's going to be a definite net gain in function. And at this point, since we're talking about wetlands, I do want to make one correction in the staff report. It was just written in a confusing way. On page 6, I talked about adding a black vinyl chain link fence, but I wasn't clear about where it was going, and essentially what we were asking for is a fencing around that wetland buffer. And this is required by code, and it's to protect the buffer from, you know, intrusion from humans and animals. And we're requesting black vinyl chain link fence. It can be a 3.5-foot fence, and as a matter of fact, next to the sidewalk, it'll have to be 3.5 feet. It couldn't be a 6-foot fence by the sidewalk. So I've just made a modification to page 6 that says, I'll go ahead and read it out to you. It's on the bottom paragraph on 6. Staff is recommending a black vinyl-coated chain-link fence surrounding track 999 to minimize potential future disturbances such as unintended intrusion into the wetland and the buffer area. And then there's a minor amendment to the conditions of approval. And this is on page 14. It's condition number 17. And right now, originally, I just had a condition in there that asked for signage around the NGPA, even though the code requires fencing too. So I just want to make it really clear and add in the words. It says, prior to issuance of certificate of occupancy, the edge of the NGPA track shall be, I want to add the words, fenced and then identified with permanent signs or markers every 100 feet. So I'm just clarifying in the staff report. Like I said, it is required by code, but let's just make it clear that we do want that wetland fenced.
Okay, well, why don't we get your clarification in as one of the exhibits of market,
okay.
Exhibit 24, the one that was kind of skipped there. Any objections over entry of Ms. Ringstead's clarification as 24? Okay, hearing none, that's admitted. All right.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, the city does use our SEPA to request mitigation, and we did issue the MDNS, as I mentioned earlier, and we are requesting traffic mitigation for the city. However, on this one, the county did review it, and the project doesn't impact any of the county projects above their 3 p.m. peak hour trip threshold. So the county said that they aren't required to submit mitigation to the county for this project. We're requesting mitigation for neighborhood parks and community parks. And in addition to that, any residential development that isn't within 1/4 mile of a residential park, a neighborhood park, is required to put in some type of mini park tot lot facility. And thus, we do have that condition asking them to put in the playground equipment on top of the stormwater vaults to create a little bit of a mini park. And like I said before, this will just be a tot lot. It'll be maintained by the HOA. The school district also requires mitigation, and so there's a condition in there requesting mitigation for the school district. And all the mitigation needs to be paid prior to final plat approval or issuance of the first building permit, whichever comes first. Okay. And now, there were a couple special fire district conditions on this plat. The internal roadway, as you could see from the plat map, it's a loop road. It serves as a fire apparatus access road with a single point of entry. And because of that, and because of the fact that it's 26 feet wide, no on-street parking is allowed. And right now, there is only parking allowed on one side of Phase 1. But when Phase 2 gets developed, it's going to have to be no parking on the entire loop. And as a condition of approval, we're asking the developer to install the no parking signs in Phase 1 as well as Phase 2. And I did take a drive out there, and it turns out it's not the big impact that you might initially think, because just given the way the driveway cuts fall, and there's also a fire hydrant down on the end, there's really only about 4 legal parking spaces on the street anyway in that whole Phase 1. So it's not a big impact to lose those, or not as big as it could have been. I guess I'm sure if you have it right in front of your house, you might feel like it's a bigger impact. But both the driveways have room for 2 cars. The garages have room for 2 cars. So that's 4 spaces per house. And the code requires 2. So they're well exceeding the code requirement. And then the other fire department condition, because of the fact that it is the fire apparatus access road with a single entry, all new construction is required to be equipped with residential fire sprinklers. And this would also include that last house in 1 that is going to be developed. It would also have to have the fire sprinklers. Okay. Staff finds that the proposed preliminary plat as conditioned, is consistent with the land use map and the comp plan and the applicable development regulations, and thus staff is recommending approval. And I'm available for questions if you have any at this point.
Okay, a few. Now, the staff report mentioned that LOS at one of the intersections was reduced from A to B. I'm assuming
yes.
that that's still above adopted LOS.
Oh, yeah.
What's the adopted LOS? Is it C or D or something, or do you know?
Well, actually, that one isn't within our LOS standards. I think they were looking at the various one, but that one isn't one of the ones that's in our comp plan that has a minimum.
Oh,
I
see.
I think they were just making a commentary that that was the only impact that it was. But it's
And what it is, it's just the left turn
right.
into the development.
Yeah.
And so this is really kind of like a relatively new intersection for the city because phase one hasn't been there that long. So, yeah, I think the last time we did our comp plan, that intersection didn't even exist.
Oh, okay. So your comp plan actually assigns individual LOSs to each intersection. That's interesting.
Mainly the signalized.
Yeah, yes, okay, yeah. And obviously LOSB is not, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Can't complain about that. Now, the Mill Creek Code also requires conformity to state subdivision standards, which, and one of the mandatory ones is that you provide for safe walking conditions to and from school. I mean, are kids going to be walking to school from this site, or are they going to be walking to bus stops? And either way, are there going to be sidewalks all the way to the from the residences to wherever they're going?
To be honest, I'm not exactly sure where they'd be going. There is an elementary school relatively close just across the street. There is, with phase one, they did put in a bus pad, though, for, you know, kids waiting for the bus from there.
Oh, okay, so there's actually a bus stop in the subdivision then?
There's the bus pad.
Or on the street frontage?
It's like a bus pad, and it's right out on, I think it's on 132nd.
Oh, I see. Okay, on 132nd.
Yeah.
And are there sidewalks all the way up and down 132nd and you know, pretty far, or do you know?
Yes. Oh, okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Yes,
I'm trying to remember.
Okay. Also, you know, for critical areas, are wetlands the only critical areas at the site? I mean, I know there was a critical areas report. They said there are no fish in conservation and no streams and just the wetland itself, but I wasn't sure about aquifer recharge or geotech. I mean, I took a look at the geotech report, and it said it was just responding to issues in the stormwater analysis, so I didn't know if anyone had looked at whether there was any geological hazard areas there. It looks like since it's pretty flat that...
Yeah, it is. It's like a...
Yeah. So is within an aquifer recharge area, though, or not? Do you know? Or
I don't believe so, but
okay.
Possibly the applicant might have one of the consultants that could address that.
Oh, okay. I was just curious on that point. Also, I noticed in prior staff reports dealing with subdivisions, there was mention of the interlocal agreement with the fire district and that fire mitigation fees would be paid, and that wasn't mentioned in this one. Are they exempt for some reason?
That's because right now we do not have a current ILA with the fire district.
Oh, I see. So
that's something that's on our work program.
Yeah,
we're working on it.
Yeah. And as you probably know, fire mitigation fees aren't subject to vesting. They only come into play when someone is going through the building permit review process. So even though it's not mentioned now, it could still apply later, I think. Yeah.
If I could add a little bit, the mitigation fees were put in at the time that the fire station was built quite some time ago, and the mitigation program, that's all been paid off. So basically,
that's nice.
Basically the reason for the fee was gone. Now, we could renegotiate it and look at it a different way, but all the circumstances with that interlocal agreement have basically been fulfilled.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing that's always struck me as kind of odd, and it's a very common practice, is a lot of cities, not all of them, but a lot of them, do identify what the mitigation fees are for traffic and parks in the staff recommendation, and they want that put in the conditions of approval, and I always felt that was kind of, from the city standpoint, shooting yourself in the foot, because they don't vest until building permit review. And so if you lock yourself into it right now, you can't change it later, whereas if you didn't mention it, you would just impose it during building permit review with whatever had been adopted at that point. So
we impose it with the CEPA, so
like I said, a lot of jurisdictions do it. Not CEPA's a little more different, but even then, like I said, it just seems odd to me to lock yourself in, you know, early on, but good for the applicant anyway. They know what they're going to be hit with. And then finally, Condition number 31 says fire lane signs as specified in the IFC shall be posted on the property. Does that encompass no parking that was mentioned in the staff report?
So when you're
characterizing something as a fire lane sign, that's actually no parking sign is what that means.
Yes.
Is that, okay, all right. I wasn't entirely sure about that. Okay, yeah, I think I hit all the my questions. Great, thank you.
Okay.
All right, let's move on to applicants. Applicants, if you want to add anything, now's your chance.
Hello, my name is Robert Fitzmaurice, and I'm representing the applicant, Crestview 2 LLC. And we don't have anything additional at this time to add to the staff's comment, but to your question, there were no additional critical areas that were noted to, by the city in any of their portfolios beyond the wetlands.
Oh, okay. All right. Great. And Mr. Fitzmaurice, you were sworn in, correct?
Yes.
At least I have to get that in the record. Okay, great. Thank you very much. All right, well, let's move on to public comments. We have any neighbors here today? Anybody who wanted to add anything? Okay, sir, in the orange, you can go on up. But I got a sign-in sheet here, too. So.
Yes, my name is Glenn Vadera. I live in Wexford Court, and I live adjacent to what will be lots 9 and 8. I'm particularly concerned about lot 9.
Yeah, let's do that. And Mr. Vadera, that's V-E-D-E-R-O, is that right?
V-E-D-E-R-A.
Hey, okay. And have you been sworn in, Mr. Vadera?
I have.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, I'll start off with one of the first things I'm concerned about is I've lived in my house for 31 years, and we've enjoyed the fact that that particular lot behind us has not been developed and have enjoyed the wildlife in that lot. And there's considerable numbers of birds that fly in and out of there, and I don't see where there's been any mitigation that's going to be done or what's going to happen with all those flocks of birds that come in and out. I'm also concerned about the construction that's going to be going on that will drive rats, raccoons, moles, bees, hornets' nests, everything into the surrounding neighborhoods because of the construction. And I know this happened from phase one. Which was actually two lots further over.
Yeah. So, where'd you say? Did you say you're just joining lot 10 or something? Or?
No, I'm going to straddle lot 8 and 9.
Oh, lot 8 and 9. Okay, gotcha.
It's down in the very corner.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So I noticed in reading the exhibit one here and looking at the plot here that the setback has changed from phase one. I remember I came to the meeting for phase one, and they got a variance of the setback, and I thought it actually was 15 feet, not 10 feet. But now it's going to be 25 feet, which I was pretty joyed about. But then when I saw what the plot is, that corner lot, the way they squeezed it in there, it kind of negates any kind of setback at all because it says in the exhibit here that there's a 10-foot buffer between houses, but they can shift it right up to the property line, which means that they could shift it to the east, which would be right up against my fence line. And a 35-foot structure right on the fence line does not appeal to me whatsoever.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Ring said if you could respond to that during staff rebuttal. I'm kind of curious about that shifting. That it would be allowed to go all the way up to the property line. But I'll let you address that when you get a chance.
Some other issues I would like to address are the construction issues that we experienced during phase one. One of them was the compaction issues. There was considerable vibration that we felt because of the till, I'm going to assume. It extended over to us, and it went on for months. Day in, day out. That's quite annoying, and I'm wondering, is there a vibration regulation as to how much they can, because you can adjust the vibration on that equipment, and there's ways to even eliminate the vibration by your compaction techniques.
Okay.
The other issue was there was considerable construction due to utility changes. And I'm wondering during phase two if that will occur as well as it did in phase one, or whether they accommodated all the utility changes that would need to be made in phase one to accommodate phase two.
So you're talking about trenching in the road and that kind of thing?
Yeah, and I can understand why they had to do it in the middle of the night because, you know, you don't want to interrupt commuter traffic on 132nd. But having those backup whistles and all that going off at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, when people have to go to work, it's really annoying.
Yeah.
Now, I've only got Exhibit 1 here, but I was flipping through it rapidly, and it looks like that the traffic study has been updated from the 2014 study for this project.
Is that right, Ms. Ringstead?
Yeah, okay.
Because it's going to be a real struggle for those 50 houses to get out and make a left-hand turn heading west on 132nd. I know living in Wexford Court, we have a considerable amount of problem just getting out onto 136th because of the high school traffic at 7:30 in the morning. So I just don't see how that's going to work, but that's for them to deal with. I just wanted to make that point, though. Okay, that's all I have.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Padera. Oh, a lot of good points. All right, Brian Ripley, did you want to say anything? Okay. And Ms. Ripley, have you been sworn in?
Excuse me?
Have you been sworn in?
No.
Oh, okay. Let me swear you in real quick. You swear affirm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay, great. That's R-I-P-L-E-Y. Is that your last name?
I was not. I live in Wexford Court, too. I have for the last 25 years. The issue I see here is a kind of twofold. Number one, I was a contractor for 40 years, so I understand codes, setbacks, and such. Thank God for somebody pushed sprinklers, because there's no way in hell you'd be able to fight a fire in that neighborhood. Absolutely none. And I've seen some fires that are tremendous. One thing I want to stress is traffic density. I don't think that anybody's really looked at this very well. With the apartments that went across the street and this phase one and now phase two, you're going to tell me there are only 22 cars that are going to go out of that thing? I don't believe it. I do not believe it. And as far as the noise, there is a noise ordinance in Mill Creek, is there not?
Yeah, I think so.
Is there?
Mm-hmm. There is, Mr. Rogers, right?
Okay, and that is from what time to what time can they construct?
I believe it's 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. on the weekdays. It's an hour shorter, I think, on Sunday. And it's also construction noise is exempt during the daytime hours. So during the nighttime, the construction noise, there's different standards for construction. There's an exemption for, because there's going to be noise when there's construction. So there's a difference. There's daytime hours and there's nighttime hours.
There should be a difference between next to a commercial structure, commercial structures, and next to residential.
I can look up what exactly it says, but there is a noise ordinance, but construction is generally exempt during the daytime hours.
Daytime hours starting at 7.
7 to, yep, till 9 at night, and then
to 9
on Sunday, yeah.
Okay, but I'm going to build a shopping center right next to your house. This 9 o'clock at night is not acceptable. It is not acceptable, and that, I don't know who thought that one up, but that's just wrong. Think about it. Man, it doesn't make sense. We went through, the ground was shaking in that first, it was like an earthquake all day long.
For months.
Yeah, for a month.
Over a month.
And, I pity the people that have backyards to it. Luckily, mine's on the other side of the street from them. And I only came because I got the notice. I didn't get the notice. Probably did get the notice for the first Crestview, and I would have said something then. Am I mistaken that they mentioned they're only going to be two-story houses?
Yes.
And they end up being three? How did that get through?
Yeah, they chipped us on that one.
I'm asking, how did that get through?
Call it, you can answer that during staff rebuttal, Ms. Ringstead. Yeah.
Excuse me?
Yeah, she'll answer it during the staff rebuttal period.
Okay. As, I mean, that when I saw these things going up, and I can see straight at the water tower and the backside of these houses, when I saw the second story and then a third going up, I thought, what the? Well, they took out all the trees. And you wouldn't believe what I had to go through to get to remove one dead tree. I had to go through the permit process. And now you're taking out how many trees?
All of them. They're taking out all of them.
No, that's wrong. So.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Ridley.
All I can say is traffic needs to be looked at. Okay. If it isn't, shame on you all.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ripley. Let's see, Ms. Suzuki, do you want to say anything?
Takao Suzuki.
Okay, and have you been sworn in, Mr. Suzuki?
I did, yes.
Okay, great.
And this is the first time to come to this type of hearing, so I apologize if the way which I ask the questions to others. Simply I have a few questions that the could you clarify the setback you said, the 25 feet from where to where in that figure?
And she'll answer all your questions once we're done with all the comments.
So oh, I see. Okay.
Put it all together. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then if you don't hear your question answered when Ms. Ringstead answers all the questions, just raise your hand and we'll make sure.
Okay. And okay, so that's a setback question. And then also I'd like to ask what the plan for the interface between the phase one and two, just, you know, the line in between, that's horizontal line, and whether you doubly prepare the fence or do you share the fence or the fence changed or how does the property taken care? And also the height of that property that he mentioned, that it's three-story. You know, right now the phase one has a three-story building for sure. Yes, and I want to make sure that what the height and the, I'm not exactly sure what the restriction regarding the height versus the setback and how, you know, the line of view or line of light is secured. And I'm not sure whether this is a part of this hearing, but the question about what's the plan for the HOA administration or other properties, how can I say, the sharing policy, that would that be shared with the phase one owners or would that be perfectly separately run? Those are the old questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Suzuki.
Shall I stay here or should I go?
Oh, no, I'm going to have a seat, and then, as I said, Ms. Ring said when it's her turn to speak, we'll answer your questions and everyone else's, and then if you don't hear your question answered, just raise your hand. So is there anyone else from the neighbors, anyone from the public who want to say anything at this point? All right, Ms. Ring said it looks like you got a lot of topics to address there, so.
Okay, I think I got them all, but if I forgot any, let me know. One of the first questions was regarding the setbacks, and this is medium density residential zone, so let me just review those really quick. The rear yard setbacks are 25 feet. The front yard setbacks are 15 or 20 feet. Where it's in front of a garage, it has to be at least 20 because we need to maintain ability to park two cars there. So it could vary a little bit along the front, but in front of the garage, it's going to be 20. And then the side yard setback is 10 feet. And the code does say that you can put all of it on one side, but that's a different product, and they're not, you know, that would be maybe like an attached, and that's not what they're proposing. When you look at the plot map here, you see the little dashed line. That's showing the setbacks, and that shows a potential building envelope, not necessarily exactly where it's going to be built, just where it could be built.
So the minimum setback on lot 10, I believe, in the southeast corner there is going to be 10 feet. it's not going to be.
Right, and actually it's, I think it's lot 9.
Oh, it's lot 9.
Yeah, okay. right in the very corner. And the folks that were interested, this is their lot right here. Mm-hmm. And it's going to have to be 20, so that first dashed line, that would be the 15-foot one, but it can't be 15 feet in front of the garage.
Right, right. But I think what they're concerned about is the side lot.
This lot right here. And
that's the minimum of 10.
And, well, actually, I think the code says a minimum of 10 total, both sides. But it looks to me like they're showing 10 feet here.
Now, I thought you said that the shifting wouldn't be allowed for this project. So.
Yeah, it's not going to be an attached product. So, no, they won't be right at the property line.
Okay, so 10 feet is the minimum setback there then.
For the side yards. But that can be combined between both sides.
I'm trying to assure them that it's not going to be less than 10 feet.
When it's a single family product, what they've done is they've actually put the dashed lines on there, which will rule on the plat. We've asked them to put them on there. They'll be on the final plat as well. So in this case, on lot 9.
But can you say at this point if it's going to be less than 10 feet?
It'll be 10 on the one side and 5, at least 10 on the side next to the other houses and 5 feet to the next house.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's what I was
trying to
find out.
So it's going to be a total of 15 on that lot.
No less than 10 feet on the perimeter there.
Yes.
Okay. That's what I was going for. Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that. And someone else had a question about utilities and about putting them in at night. That is not typical. Usually there wouldn't be any night work on the site. Every once in a while, if the work is intended to be in the middle of a busy road, they might get special permission to work at night.
Okay, wait.
I mean, do you know if there'll be any more utility extensions involved?
No, there shouldn't be. They are connecting for their water to a stub out in Wexford Court, but that's up here by lot 14.
Oh, okay.
And then the sewer manhole is already in.
Okay.
It was put in as a part of phase 1.
And there's not going to be any digging for cable TV or internet, none of that stuff either, as far as you know.
That part, I'm not sure. I would imagine that it might be part of the construction. Mm. That makes sense.
Sewer manhole is in.
Yeah, that's the big one. Okay.
But they won't be doing it at night, I guess is my point.
Yeah, that's
they will have 7 to 9 construction hours. Mm. And somebody had made a comment on the construction vibration and a certain technique that might lessen that. I'm not aware of one, so possibly the applicant could address that. I don't know if there is a way that you can do it that's got less vibration.
I mean, has the phase 2 been graded already? Wouldn't that be the major source of the vibration already or not?
Well, I imagine there's going to be some more grading that has to happen, not a ton.
Okay. And then what happens is when they put the houses themselves in, there may be some site work done, like for under the foundation or something, which would explain why it would be spaced out over time as they build the houses one by one.
Yeah. Somebody else commented on the traffic report, and they said something about 22, and it's actually 25 p.m. peak hour trips. That's what the mitigation is based on. And it was a very thorough traffic report, looked at intersections, it looked at a lot of stuff that traffic reports don't always get to. So I thought it was a pretty thorough traffic report. And they are paying mitigation. The mitigation to the city is $97,500, I think, which is goes towards city projects that will hopefully help traffic down the run. And then as far as the 3 stories, the code doesn't actually limit number of stories. What they limit is the height. And the height of the building in a medium density residential can be 35 feet. So if they can fit 3 stories in 35 feet, it meets the code.
Yeah. Do you have any idea where the perception came from that there were just going to be 2 stories? Or?
No, okay. I don't. I'm sorry. That wasn't my project, and I know we don't typically talk about it as far as number of stories allowed. We talk about it allowed building height. And There was a comment also about the trees, and it is true that a majority of the trees on the site are going to have to go. There are a couple of trees in the wetland tract, though, that are going to be retained. But to develop these lots, it will require removal of those trees that are back. There is the back southeast corner back here that has a nice stand of trees on it.
Can I ask a question?
Uh-huh.
So there's the existing neighborhoods have...
No, Mr. Verder, I need you to go to the mic there if you could. Thanks.
The existing neighborhoods have landscaping up against the back of their lots. So if you're going to do clearing and grubbing up to the fence line, what's going to happen with the roots of the trees from the adjoining lots? That's going to kill those trees.
Oh, you know, I agree that, and...
I've got a 30-year-old maple that I'm concerned about, even though I set it back when I planted it, 10 feet from the fence. I mean, it's going to have roots that run, and I would prefer that they don't get disturbed.
Right. And, Tom, I'm going to let you take that one, because I'm not sure exactly what we can do on that.
Well, there's not a great answer to that. It's really hard. It's a case-by-case, tree-by-tree. I think that we have a lot of neighborhoods that developed over time next to each other, and once in a while a certain tree will be an issue, and we'll try to take steps to save that particular tree. No trees have been actually identified as being a specific one. We can work with the applicant as we lay it out and see if there is something we can do. Certainly, if the work that is done on one private property affects something of value on another person's property, that's a legal issue. That's a civil matter between the two property owners. And I think that maybe the applicant talk about how willing they are to sort of look at those things in the field and kind of work with it, but that's at a level of detail that hasn't been really looked at.
I mean, is the grading, with the 25-foot setback, is the grading really going to be all the way to the property line, you think? Or
strip the whole property.
The setbacks were different phases.
Right, that's true. Yeah. And on the ones where they're 25 feet, I would imagine they don't have to go all the way to the property line, but I'd like the applicant
to address that. Yeah, the applicant address that. I know some clearing and grading codes require that the roots of trees be identified and sometimes, marked off or something. I don't know if Mill Creek does that, but it's a controversial subject because case law says that the roots from an adjoining tree are trespassing, basically, and that the property owner has a right to remove those roots if it's necessary for their development. So, as Mr. Rogers said, it's not an easy situation. All right, Ms. Ringstead, go ahead.
Okay, and the last question that I had, someone asked about the HOA, and I did confirm that they do have to have an HOA. They will establish an HOA because the HOA is responsible for maintenance of the open space and the roadway buffer and the wetland, but they're not going to join with the Phase 1 HOA. It'll be a separate new HOA.
Can I add one thing? Is that once those two are established, they could merge at a later date. We've had cases of that in the past. But
did the applicant request to have a separate HOA, or was that just something the city?
The applicant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I did an aerial photo of that back corner, so we can kind of see, it does look like there might be some trees right on the boundary, that, hopefully we could try to protect some of the root zone, but a lot of that lot looks pretty cleared, that lot looks cleared. So maybe it'll impact some trees, but maybe not as many.
We'll let the applicant address that if they can.
Okay. Were there any more for me?
Well, there's the rodent control question, which I've heard in a lot of projects. I think I might have required once or twice that you get some rodent control person out there to do it. But, I mean, the thought of throwing out buckets of chemicals, and it doesn't seem like the best solution either, so... I don't know. Has the city dealt with the rodent control issue before? It comes up quite a bit.
Not to my knowledge.
It's just, I hate to say it like this, but when there's development, there are the little critters and stuff.
Yeah.
There's nothing that's been identified that's a priority habitat species or an endangered species, so there's going to be some adjustment, and it happens with every development.
Mm-hmm. And there is the wetland buffer up in the top corner, and they are enhancing that, so maybe some of the wildlife can migrate down that way.
Okay. Well, and I think there was a question. I don't know if I understood it correctly about the shared fence line or something. That was Mr. Suzuki's question, right?
Yeah, I forgot that one. I believe right now, and let's see if that photo shows it. I think there is fencing all the way down in phase one. Yeah.
Right there.
See, the phase one is on the right here, mm-hmm. and there's fencing all the way down. It doesn't make sense to me that they would put in a new backyard fence. Usually when two lots adjoin, they share a fence. So that would seem the logical way to go to me, but I would defer to the applicant on that again.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Ms. Ringstead. All right, applicants, now you get the final word here. Oh, Mr. Suzuki, yeah. Oh, pardon? Sure, go up.
So could you go back to that photo? About the fence.
The fence photo?
Fence
this
photo.
Guy right here?
Yeah, just a curious. Yeah, that's fine. The two questions that I really wanted to ask, the one was that probably I misused the word setback, but asking the distance from that fence to the property building on their backyard. I don't know whether that's called a setback.
Well,
but
the
elevation is 25 feet.
My second question, but...
The allowed building height is 35 feet.
Right. But I mean distance from that fence to the property building distance.
It's 25 feet.
Oh, that's a 25?
Oh,
and,
okay.
And equally,
okay.
Is that equally 25?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, yes, along backing
long
up
phase
to that
one,
interior road.
Long phase
25
feet without exception.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can see there's 25
between
feet.
Between that center line to the property building, yeah, that one is 25. Okay, so uniformly 25. Mm-hmm. The phase one, it's not uniform.
No, phase one is like, I thought it was 10, but it could be 15 feet.
But it's not uniform across the house.
And it's at least 25 feet.
Oh, 20, you mean the houses are staggered a little bit?
Okay.
Yeah.
And the other question is, the elevation. That the elevation currently has a probably like 3 feet elevation difference. How do you plan to do that between the phase one and the phase two? So do you actually put the soil there to elevate the phase two property, or I'm not quite understanding that part. If you look at that picture, it's clear that
they look to be relatively on a pretty much the same elevation to me.
Oh, they did?
They raised it.
Okay, I'll leave that to the applicant as well.
Okay. And can I ask one more question that came up? Okay. So I'm living in the phase one, and I personally haven't parked on the road. But you mentioned that only 4 spots are legally allowed,
right?
Which probably in practice, violated a couple once in a while.
Right.
Is that practical that both sides will not be allowed to park, right?
Right, and that's a fire code.
Right,
issue.
Right. I understand that. Now, 25 people living there, when I see the situation, guests coming. Party going on, which hardly ever happened in my house, so that's why I haven't ever parked over there. But would that be practical? So that in the neighbor, I don't see much space if that is prohibited. Then sometimes people park that actually the exit road across in 23rd Street. For example, when they are bringing their kids to wait for the area. And then I do have a concern that the people start to park in a more illegal places, practically, whether that's accommodatable. So, thank you.
Okay.
Okay. All right, Mr. Rinsett, thank you. Now moving on to applicants, and especially the vibration, that seems to be a really big issue for the neighbors, and if you could address that.
Again, my name is Robert Fitzmaurice, and I've been sworn in. So I'll go over some of the things that I heard. So regarding the pest control plan, We'd be happy to stipulate to do a pest control plan for this particular project and set up a pest management.
What would be involved in that? Like I said, I'm just a little afraid. I've kind of left it open-ended before, and then afterwards I'm thinking, my God, what is somebody going out there with vats of, you know, poisons and stuff? That neighbors probably wouldn't want to see that either.
My understanding is that the pest abatement company goes out and looks for the rats. I don't know exactly how they trap them. I'm sure whatever's allowed under Washington state law to get rid of the pests, whatever those pests are. But we'd be happy to do a pest control plan as part of the conditions of approval. The noise standards and the vibration, we're complying with all the city noise ordinances. I hadn't heard the vibration, but as Mr. Rogers said, you know, with construction there is vibration, and I think that if it was extended vibration over a long period of time, it was probably due to compaction related around the home construction themselves. We are not home builders. We're just the developers of the real estate, so I can't really speak to the home building side of that. But during the roadway construction, usually at the end, there is some compaction with vibratory rollers.
And how long would that go? I mean, that doesn't take that long, does it, to put in the road?
Not that particular part, no.
Yeah, that's like a week maybe or something? A
couple weeks or something like that. So it's not an extended period of time where they're rolling the material that's on the actual road. Let's see here. There was a comment about the nighttime work in the state highway. So that's a state highway requirement. The state highway doesn't allow you to work there during daytime hours, so there had to be some connections to utilities during the Phase 1 project, and that's why there was nighttime work in the state highway, because that's
you
the only time.
You don't see any
necessary. So all of the utility mains have been tied in there, and there's a small connection to a storm drain that's on 132nd, but we'll be coming in through the backside, so we won't be actually in the state highway. We'll be in the right-of-way area. But we won't be in the traffic lane or doing nighttime work. We do not anticipate. It's Washington State who makes the rules in their right-of-way. So I just don't anticipate any work in the right-of-way, in the roadway. The Lot 9 10-foot setback, we're fine with the 10-foot setback on Lot 9. We'll stipulate to that as a condition of approval.
Yeah, it sounds like it can't be any less anyway, but yeah, I could throw that in, sure.
As far as the tree issue, we'll be complying with all the state laws regarding the trees. And
I mean, do you think there'll be a need actually to grade all the way to the property line with the 25-foot setback, or, I mean, do you foresee that?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I mean, typically, the edge condition is always the concern of not getting the edge condition at the end. I'm not saying we're going to the very property line. Sometimes it's 2 feet, whatever. Yeah. But for the builder to construct their property, they don't want to leave a bunch of invasive blackberries all the way to the edge. And when you say clearing, I don't know that it's all a bulldozer or something like that, but they will be clearing all of that
brush. I mean, what if they do see a, you know, a giant oak tree that's right on the property line? I mean, will that be taken into consideration?
The roots are always taken into consideration when they're grading.
Okay.
Exactly what I don't know the specific situation now, but it is taken into consideration. And with the 10-foot buffer, the house will be 10 feet away from the property line, so I would imagine that the roots would be back from the fence that it is now. Yeah. The tree doesn't extend 20 feet over the fence line now.
Well, the problem is that when they built Wexford Court, they ripped off the topsoil. And so we've got till virtually on the surface. So whenever we put the trees in, the roots have a hard time getting in. So they're built very close to the surface.
So they go on the surface.
Okay. That was Mr. Vadera for the record.
Okay, and then the last one regarding the fence and the wall. So the situation that exists now is what we anticipate to occur in the future. The property line is actually adjacent to the wall, and then after the wall comes the fence, and then comes the house of the neighbors in the development of Phase 1. So we will be filling, I think it's a foot in that area, minimal filling against that wall. So the grades will essentially remain the same, whereas Phase 2 is slightly lower than Phase 1 below the wall that's there, and we don't have any anticipation of putting a fence along that line. It would create a trash hazard or trash corridor where things would end up in between the two fences, and we don't try and encourage that type of development.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzmaurice. A question for Mr. Ripley back there.
Again. Mm-hmm.
So you said the wall that you're going to be infilling to a wall, and that's can you bring up that one slide that showed the lot lines, please?
This one.
Where is that located?
This one.
That's the there's the wall.
No.
Yeah.
The first one up above. Number six, I think it is, yeah.
Okay.
Slide six.
This one right here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is slide six? Okay.
So along 10 or along 20?
Oh, yeah, if you could answer Mr. Fitzmaurice.
Robert Fitzmaurice again. So this is the existing wall that was constructed during the development of Phase 1.
Okay.
And so it's along those, the tier of lots to the eastern edge, which would be on the western edge of this proposed development.
Down the middle. And then when you look at this photo, you can see the wall.
Okay, so along that line that's intersecting between
this line, right?
1 and 2,
mm-hmm.
At their property down on your number 10, what's your zero elevation differential between their property and that property? I'm standing in their backyard. I'm at zero.
Here to there.
No, I'm talking about right here.
We're not building a wall in that area.
Well, I'm not talking about the area. I'm talking about this 35-foot range, and is there going to be a differential between their property and this?
We're discussing this wall here. There's right. No other intended walls anywhere on
okay.
The property.
I agree. I understand that. What I'm asking now is, the elevation here, is it the same elevation here?
Generally, yes.
Generally, yes. Okay. So, to ask the question again, what was the timing on the sound ordinance?
It's 7 a.m. to 9 p.m.
7 to 9 on weekdays?
Uh-huh. And then 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Sunday.
8 a.m. to how long?
9 p.m. It just starts an hour later.
Saturday and Sunday? Okay, and who is it, because this has happened on phase one. Don't know that you who was the contractors, but they started earlier than 7 o'clock, and they worked later than 9. So who do we call?
City staff.
Yeah, if it's during non-working hours, you dial 911, and the police will be out there.
Okay.
Yes. The noise ordinance is enforced by the police department.
And last question I got is on your traffic report. When how did they do the traffic report? Did they do it with a sensor lead across 132nd? Or did they just have somebody go out there for a day and sit?
I'd be happy to give you a copy of the traffic report.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert, so I really hesitate.
Well, the only way I know of doing an accurate traffic study is to have a sensor, and that is to count the number of cars that are going through. And I don't recall one ever being done out there.
As staff, I'd say that the traffic report was done to the city's satisfaction. It was submitted to consultants and reviewed. I'm not a traffic expert either, mm-hmm. So whether it had a sensor or not, I'm not sure. But it's in the record, and you could review it.
I mean, Mr. Fitzgerald, did you recall how the traffic counts were done in your traffic report? Okay. Right. Okay, Mr. Ripley,
thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, and the applicants, you get final word if you wanted to respond to any of that. Okay, I'll close the hearing. A lot of good points have been raised, and like I said, I'll be reviewing the tapes, and I'll be issuing a written decision. Ms. Ring said you're going to be mailing that out, decision, to everyone who signed in the sign-in sheet. Is that correct? All right. So if you want a copy of the written decision, which will respond to all the comments that you made, make sure you're on the sign-in sheet, and Ms. Ringstead will have it once the hearing is closed. So I appreciate you coming out this evening, and the hearing is done for today. Thank you.
Oh, hit restarting? That's not smart.
Okay. And you're gonna find out.
We will write an honest report.
And this is the first. I'm I'll call you and let you know what it's like.
Well, you've seen it.
I do.
I'm sorry. I'll put my name on it. Fitz and I live together. So,
wetlands like that.
KO. And myself and Kevin Taylor are the principals. And so I will set up the arborist. We'll get him out there to take a look at it. And actually, it's a good idea to do that anyway, because trees are shooting. So I typically will not take a tree down if we're not grading the area. I'll let the builder decide if he wants to take a tree just kind of go along. I'll look at it. As long as, again, it's, as long as it's a respectful conversation, I'm here. Not so much.
Thanks a lot.
Listen, thank you. Appreciate your comment.
Actually, I look forward to seeing the neighbors.
It'll be in a river. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
They said, oh, they're only going to be two-story homes. And I've been watching three-story before. You know, 35 feet, I've gone through this before with cities. And I've played the game myself, around, so it doesn't surprise me, you know, but you're going to be looking straight up at the backside for the side of the house. All the ones on the south side are three-story.
Most of the south side
are three-story. Yeah, I mean, you turn up right at it.
If you get inside, then the third floor is really weird.
Well, they call it a bonus room. It's not really a story.
The bonus room is actually the room that doesn't really have the door. But the third floor is almost like a loft, some of the houses.
Well, I'm kind of curious. I just noticed, because I didn't see it before, these lots are a lot smaller than your lot.
Oh, yeah.
Did you notice that? Your lot